We're in the 17th chapter of the book of Revelation, and I'm particularly thankful to Denise and some of the rest of you in particular because you wanted us to study the book of Revelation, and I have not felt really qualified to teach the book in a long time, but be that as it may, there's a lot that know more about the book of Revelation than I do, and I'm grateful to them for their help and assistance in our studies and the materials that we're able to read and learn about. But it's been a venture for me. I really appreciate the opportunity to study these things. But in the 17th chapter, see if I can get my slides going here. In the 17th chapter, we have been studying about the great harlot and the expression Babylon the Great, the mother of the harlots, and verse 5, and we're going to continue that study tonight from the 17th chapter. But before we get into the text itself, I want to note that the expression Babylon the Great is consistently used in the book of Revelation to identify, I'm convinced, Rome, the rulers of Rome, rather than the actual size or true greatness of the city of Rome. Henry Barclay Sweet in his commentary, and this is quoted by Robert Harkrider in his commentary, and by the way, you can have Henry Barclay Sweet's commentary if you'll download it. It's in public domain online. It's an old commentary, but I think overall it's got some good statements. But we see that John uses that expression a number of times in Revelation, chapter 14, chapter 16, and we're going to get into it more emphatically as we get into the 18th chapter. Now, we mentioned this passage in Daniel, Daniel chapter 4, but didn't deal with it in our last study. Now, I want to introduce it here as kind of a springboard into what we're going to talk about. Daniel chapter 4, verses 28 through 33. You'll recognize this context as Daniel is interpreting King Nebuchadnezzar's dream. Now, this is different from Daniel chapter 2, another dream that King Nebuchadnezzar has. But in Daniel chapter 4, beginning in verse 28, it tells us all this came upon King Nebuchadnezzar at the end of 12 months. He was walking in the royal palace of Babylon. And the king spake and said, "Is not this great Babylon, which I have built for the royal dwelling place by the might of my power and for the glory of my majesty?" While the word was in the king's mouth, there fell a voice from heaven saying, "O King Nebuchadnezzar, to thee it is spoken, the kingdom is departed from thee. Thou shalt be driven from men. Thy dwelling shall be with the beast of the field, and thou shalt be made to eat grass as oxen, and seven times shall pass over thee, until thou know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will." The same hour was the thing fulfilled upon Nebuchadnezzar, and he was driven from men, and did eat grass as oxen, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, till his hair was grown like eagle's feathers, and his nails like bird's claws. Now, that's important for us to see that King Nebuchadnezzar had to learn that God rules in the kingdoms of men. Now, we have studied in Daniel chapter 2 in times gone by in connection with our study of the book of Revelation, and we've noted that Nebuchadnezzar had a dream in Daniel chapter 2. And Daniel has explained that dream to mean that there would be a sequence of kingdoms beginning, he said, with you, O King of Kings, in verse 37, whom God of heaven hath given the kingdom, the power, the strength, and the glory, that God has given this into your hand, verse 38. You're the head of gold. And this sequence of kingdoms is identified in verses 39 and 40. Of Daniel chapter 2, and we're familiar with that to know that as he starts with Nebuchadnezzar, the king of the Babylonian Empire, that his kingdom would not last. It would be followed by the Medes and the Persians, and then the Greek Empire, and then the Roman Empire. And then Daniel tells Nebuchadnezzar in the days of these kings, that is the days of the Roman kings, the God of heaven is going to set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, nor shall the sovereignty thereof be left to another people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these and stand forever. Now, we've noted that the kingdom that Daniel is prophesying about would come to pass in the days of the Roman kings. Now what we're studying in the book of Revelation is during the days of the Roman kings. And the Roman kings, that kingdom is going to end too. And Daniel has told Nebuchadnezzar that in Daniel chapter 2 and specifically in Daniel chapter 7. And so as we read in Acts chapter 2, we're not going to do that tonight, but as we study in Acts chapter 2, we see the fulfillment of what Daniel told King Nebuchadnezzar in Daniel chapter 2, that God did in the days of the Roman kings establish his kingdom, that is the church, in Acts chapter 2 on that first Pentecost following the resurrection of Christ. And after that, we read of those, for example, we studied this morning in Colossians chapter 1, verse 13, of folks being translated into the kingdom. So the kingdom was in existence during first century times. John in Revelation chapter 1 identifies himself as a fellow citizen in the kingdom. So the kingdom that Daniel was prophesying that God would establish did indeed come to pass during the days of the Roman kings. But what about that Roman entity, the Roman Empire? Daniel is telling Nebuchadnezzar, yours is going to end. And another one, and another one, and then the Roman kings. But it will end too, and we see that in Daniel chapter 7. And I think that's what's being fulfilled as John is writing here in Revelation. Now, Henry Barclay Sweet, in his commentary, makes this statement that I thought was interesting. He said, the seer ascribes to Rome a character which the prophets of Israel had ascribed to more than one of the pagan cities of antiquity. Now, one of the things that we've noted in previous studies is that this expression, Babylon the Great and the Great Harlot, and in particular the harlot, is used to talk, Babylon has been used to talk about the city of Nineveh. It's been used to talk about the city of Tyre. And now we see it used to be discussing Rome. It has also been used in Old Testament text in Ezekiel chapter 26 and following to talk about the Israelites, but to suggest that it is used in ancient antiquity to only talk about the Israelites is a misnomer. That's not true. And so what we are trying to identify is that the use of this expression, Babylon the Great, as it describes Babylon of old, it's used to describe others who were practicing qualities that were characteristic of ancient Babylon. Now, we saw that in our text of Daniel chapter 4. The king Nebuchadnezzar said, everything that I have, I've done it. And God said, no, I did it. I'm the one that brought you to this place, and I will take you out of this place. And other kings I will bring into place, such as Cyrus, the king of the Medes and the Persians that conquered Nebuchadnezzar, the king or the Babylonian Empire. Now, having said that, what we want to note is how is that term used here and why is it used? Well, it's used to characterize cities or nations that were filled with pride and arrogancy, like Babylon was, like the city of Nineveh, the capital city of the Assyrian Empire was, and like Rome was, city of Tyre, for example. The cruelty of war, the characteristics of idolatry, and all of this characterized ancient Babylon just as surely as it now currently characterizes Rome as John is writing. And the Roman kings, many of them thought that they were to be worshipped as a god or that they were God. And we've identified that Nero, to some degree, required emperor worship. But moreover, Domitian did require emperor worship. And we might note just here that these two emperors were not the only ones in the Roman entity that required that they be recognized as some kind of a god. But God is telling them very clearly, with these qualities and these characteristics, Rome will fall. And so that's what we're wanting to emphasize in our study. Well, what did they do? Let's begin our study tonight with not just a description or a characteristic of Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and the abominations of the earth. We're going to come back to that in the 18th chapter. But as John continues writing in the 6th verse, he says, "And I saw the woman drunken with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I wondered with great wonder. And the angel said unto me, Wherefore didst thou wonder? I will tell thee the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carrieth her, which hath the seven horns and the seven heads and the 10 horns." Now I want to pause just here and comment on verse 6 in particular. John is carried away in the spirit into the wilderness. And it's explained to him then what the images that he is seeing, what that really means. Some have supposed that being carried into the wilderness, much like chapter 12, would be a safe place to see what this woman really is, as opposed to the woman in Revelation chapter 12. But as we examine the scene that John has seen from verse 1, he sees this woman sitting on a scarlet beast, which would indicate the power that we're talking about, Rome, and in particular, its emperors. Now, you'll notice as John has described in the preceding verses, this harlot, full of names of blasphemy, that is against God, and you'll see that in verse 3, full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and 10 horns. Now, in our last study, and we're going to do this again tonight with a chart that I have down the stack just a little bit. But as you turn back to the 13th chapter, I think it's significant to note that the beast that's being described in the 17th chapter is the same beast that's being described in the 13th chapter. If you'll notice the description of the beast in the 13th chapter that came up out of the sea, it likewise had 10 horns and 7 heads, and on his horns, 10 diadems, and upon his heads, names of blasphemy. So this is the same image that we're seeing in the 17th chapter. The 7 heads and the 10 horns indicates power and authority. Now here's the chart that I was referencing. From the 13th chapter, in verses 1, 2, and 3, we see that the beast that is described in the 13th chapter is essentially the same as that one that's described in the 17th chapter. Now I think this is significant to look at the qualities and the characteristics. In the 13th chapter, he came out of the sea. In the 17th chapter, he came out of the abyss. In the 13th chapter, had 7 heads and 10 horns. Same is true in the 17th chapter, verses 3 and 4. In the 13th chapter, this beast warred with the saints in verse 7. In the 17th chapter, however, this beast makes war with the Lamb. And you'll notice in the third verse of the 13th chapter, that beast had one head, wounded to death, and then healed. John words it a bit differently in the 17th chapter in verse 8, but very similar. He said, was, is not, and is. And then in the third verse of the 13th chapter, he says, all the world wondered. And we've got the same thing presented here in the 17th chapter as you drop down into verse 8 of this text. Now, that's intriguing to me, but suffice it to say that the beast of the 13th chapter is the beast of the 17th chapter. Now, my question to our class is, do we see that, or do we see that there is something different being discussed in the 17th chapter from what we discussed in the 13th chapter? Bruce, you're muted. I can see your mouth move, but I can't hear you.
Yeah, it looks like Babylon, but also, you know, we see that Rome is getting ready to be destroyed.
I think that's the point. These two chapters are discussing the same thing. Now, one of the points that we've established in previous studies is that the book of Revelation often tells the story and then tells it again and then tells it again. So we have an overlay of information in the book of Revelation. Now, Notice again the description of the woman. She's arrayed in purple and scarlet. She is described as a well-dressed prostitute, if you please, adorned with gold and precious stone and pearls. And we've talked about that, having in her hand a golden cup full of abominations. Now, you would expect out of the golden cup to find great things, but not so. It's full of abomination, even the unclean things of her fornication. And that indicates the influence that she had persecuting the church and persecuting those who are Christians and trying to line up, if you please, the nations over which Rome ruled with her idolatry. You'll notice it tells us on her forehead a name was written. We've discussed many of these things and noticed that Rome does become a fitting image for Babylon. But what I want to note in our study tonight, in particular, from the sixth verse, is that the woman was drunken with the blood of the saints. You see that there in verse 6. So it's the reason why that it's stated that way. Turn back with me to Revelation chapter 6, and let's begin reading in verses 9 through 11. Now, this sets the tone, essentially, for the book of Revelation. In verse 9, it says, in chapter 6, Revelation 6, verse 9, "And when he opened the fifth seal, I saw underneath the altar the souls of them that had been slain for the word of God and for the testimony which they held. And they cried with a great voice, saying, How long, O Master, the holy and true, dost thou not judge and avenge our blood on them that dwell on the earth?" Now, that tells us some things. Here are some who are martyrs, and they're crying out from under the altar, "How long before you avenge our blood upon them that dwell upon the earth?" Well, we know that the answer to that is that they would be avenged, but it would be a little while. As you turn beyond our study from the 17th chapter, the description there in verse 6, to the 18th chapter, and look in verse 24 of that chapter as he continues to describe Babylon and its fall. He says then in verse 24, "And in her was found the blood of the prophets and of the saints and all that had been slain upon the earth." Now let me ask you, when Babylon falls, is there vindication for the saints, the blood of the prophets, and those who have been martyrs from Revelation chapter 6, verses 9 through 11? Well, obviously, that the answer is yes. There would be vindication for them. But what about this harlot? The point is that the harlot didn't care about God, didn't care about the saints that had been martyred and opposed everything that God stood for. And we saw that actually as far as the beginning of the conflict between good and evil in the 12th chapter of the book of Revelation going forward. But I think that we've got to take a look at verse 6 and see the importance of this little word "and" here. This harlot was drunken with the blood of the saints and the martyrs of Jesus, that is, obsessed to kill the saints. Now, frankly, I think that could imply, as we've discussed in times gone by, some of the faithful Old Testament saints, but in particular, or specifically, those who are members of the Lord's church. Now, my reason for making that distinction is this harlot was drunken with the blood of the saints and martyrs of Jesus. These saints could very well be some of the Old Testament saints that Rome had been responsible for, or the evil that was represented by Rome, as well as those New Testament saints who were the disciples of the Lord. Now, you'll notice that John saw this, and he just stands in amazement, astonished and amazed at what he saw. Now, somebody says, well, John didn't understand. Well, that's right. Look at verse 7. It says, "And the angel said unto me, Wherefore didst thou wonder? I will tell you the mystery." Now, we're going to come back to that in just a little bit. But the point I want us to see here is John doesn't understand what the angel has showed him. Now, there are some reasons, I think, that we need to look at why this description of Babylon the Great mystery, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth, more likely fits Rome than Jerusalem. And I want to just look at, some of the descriptions that are found in this context and related context. In the 17th chapter and in verse 18, I want to call to your attention that this woman that John sees, this harlot, he says, whom thou sawest is the great city which reigneth over the kings of the earth. That's significant. It helps us to see the dominion of this great harlot that he's describing. As far as I know, Jerusalem never ruled over the kings of the earth. That tells us a little bit about who's being described. You'll notice also in the 17th chapter, verse 1 and verse 15, this too, I think, is very significant, that this great harlot sitteth upon many waters. Now, there are those who've said, well, that's describing oceans. No, it's not talking about oceans, and we know that from the text. When you drop down in this text and the further description of the great harlot, in verse 5, it tells us what the waters are. It says, he saith unto me, the waters which thou sawest, where the harlot sitteth, are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues. Now, as far as I know, Jerusalem did not, in that respect, sit upon the waters. Now, we're not talking about geographic location. We're talking about the dominion that is described in this passage. Also in the 17th chapter, in the third verse, you'll note that this woman sits upon the beast. The Roman Empire had power over all kindreds, tongues, and nations. You see that in verse 7. And also, I think that's paralleled in the 13th chapter, as we've described in verse 7. And then the clothing of this great harlot. It says she's clothed in purple and scarlet color and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls. Notice this is the attire of rulers, those who are wealthy, those who are in power. And that too would characterize Rome, not necessarily Jerusalem. And so that's just from a political standpoint that this description that John gives here in this 17th chapter, I think, fits Rome better than Jerusalem. But as we reflect upon even geographical descriptions, we're going to drop on down in the text just for the sake of argument. And notice in the 18th chapter in verse 17 beginning, this description continues. It says, for in one hour so great riches is made desolate, every shipmaster and everyone that saileth any whither, and mariners, and as many as gained their living by sea, stood afar off and cried out as they looked upon the smoke of her burning, saying, what city is like the great city? So what we want to note on down through verse 19 is, here is a great city that goes away. It perishes. And those who were involved in marine trade grieve over this city. Now, Rome was located at the coast of the Mediterranean Sea. So as far as its geographic location is concerned, this would fit. Jerusalem was not located on the edge of the sea, although Jerusalem, I'm sure, and Israel as a whole did export through commercial cities like Tyre and Sidon, and in particular Caesarea. But as far as the commerce is concerned, the description in the 18th chapter, in verse 11 beginning, there the text tells us, after describing the great city Babylon in verse 10, verse 11, and the merchants of the earth weep and mourn for her, for no man buyeth their merchandise anymore. Merchandise of gold and silver and precious stone and pearls and fine linen and purple and silk and scarlet and thyan wood, every vessel of ivory and every vessel made of most precious wood and brass and iron and marble. And you can read the list yourselves, picking up that thought again at verse 17, where we were a few moments ago through verse 19. The trade is dramatically affected by the fall of the subject that's being discussed, which I think is Rome. And so as far as geographic locations, as far as political description, and as far as the commercial description that is given, in the book of Revelation in the 17th and 18th chapters, Rome seems to fit that description, I think, better than Jerusalem does. But be that as it may as well, look at the moral conditions that are discussed by John. He describes this harlot as clothed in scarlet. This would be the attire of a harlot. In verse 5, the mother of harlots and the abominations of the earth. Things are bad. You'll notice as in the verses that we have read in chapter 17, verse 6, she's guilty of the blood of the martyrs of Jesus and all that were slain upon the earth. So did Rome do that? Well, we know that it did. In fact, if we note back over in the 13th chapter and in verse 15, it says, and it was given unto him to give breath to it, even to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause that as many as should not worship the image of the beast should be killed. Now, did Rome do that? Well, yes. Yes, Rome was guilty of these very things. In the 18th chapter, going forward now to verse 20 and verse 24, it says, rejoice over her, thou heaven, and ye saints, and ye apostles, and ye prophets, for God hath judged your judgment upon her. Has the saints of God been avenged? Yes. When would that occur? With the falling of those who were tormenting his people. That is, in this specific, those of Rome. The Roman entity as an empire. In the 18th chapter, in verse 3 and verse 9, you'll note that they committed fornication with all the nations, kings of the earth, and merchants. Deception was one of the practices that was characteristic of the empire. So the moral conditions of Rome was prepared to fall. Now, when this city fell, once again, we'll call your attention to verse 17 through 18. Merchants mourned, but God's saints had occasion to rejoice when this city or this empire fell. Now, any questions or comments before I go forward with the 17th verse or 17th verse 7 of the 17th chapter? Any comments or questions? Well, there are two or three things I want to note from the 17th verse. I'm going to say that right, Richard. The 17th chapter, the 7th verse, okay? And the angel said unto me, wherefore didst thou wonder? Now, we've already identified that John doesn't understand the things that are being presented to him. And the angel says, I will tell thee the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carrieth her, which hath the 7 heads and the 10 horns. I'm going to tell you about that. Now, the 7 heads and the 10 horns, we've already noted from the 13th chapter that we're talking about the same beast that in the 13th chapter was identified as Rome. So I'm going to tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries her. Now, this has prompted a little bit of interest in my mind about the term mystery. And stay with me on this. And if you have some comments or questions or input on it, I would be in your debt. We've spent a good little bit of time in the 10th chapter in the 7th verse talking about this word mystery. Now, we know that the word mystery is used frequently, especially in the epistles, to talk about the mystery of salvation, redemption in Christ Jesus, how God chose to save man through the sending of his son and the establishment of his church. And we've talked about that from the 3rd chapter of Ephesians, noted that even the principalities and the powers in the heavenly places didn't understand what God intended to do and how he accomplished it. And when it was done, they were made to be in awe of God's plan of salvation. Now, that's one way that the word mystery is used. In fact, quite frequently it's used that way. But personally, I'm not convinced that every time we see the word mystery, we need to think of the scheme of redemption. Now, though it's many times used that way, to suggest that it's always used that way might be an overstatement. Now, when we look at this passage in Revelation chapter 10 and verse 7, and parallel that to what we're reading about concerning this great harlot, Babylon the Great, it's described as a mystery. But in Revelation chapter 10 in verse 7, the writer is indicating that God's judgment would delay no longer. Verse 7, he said, but in the days of the voice of the seventh angel, when he is about to sound, then is finished the mystery of God, according to the good tidings which he declared unto his servants, the prophets. Now, all of that verse, I think, the little expressions that are found in, they're just weighty with significance. Whatever the mystery is of verse 7 of chapter 10 was something that had not yet come to pass that this angel is telling John about. But the development of the scheme of redemption had already been revealed. It had already been preached. It had been preached in Acts chapter 2. It had been written down by the Apostle Paul, as he states in Ephesians chapter 3. So the mystery of the scheme of redemption in Christ had already been made known. The word mystery simply means something that has not yet been made known. Well, what is it that could possibly be the mystery of Revelation 10 or the mystery of Revelation 17 verse 7? Or the mystery, as we see in Revelation chapter 13 and verse 18. Now, though the word mystery is not used in Revelation 13 verse 18, the thought is presented. The word mystery is in Revelation 10:7 and 17:7. But look at the text of Revelation 13 verse 18. We've noted in this chapter that he is discussing those who have received the mark of the beast on their right hand and on their forehead, verse 16, and that would enable them to be able to buy and sell. But as you drop to the 18th verse, he says, here is wisdom. He that hath understanding, let him count the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. Now, that was something mysterious. At least John considered it so, and many have. But the point being, here is wisdom. He that has understanding, let him count the number. So it was a mystery that was to be made known, but it could be known. It could be known. Now, our point is that in the text of Revelation 13, verse 18, as we studied through that, we noted that the number 666 does not identify a specific man. And I'm familiar with the argument of gematria, where some assign certain numbers to letters of a man's name and correlate and figure out, well, this must be a certain man's name. The evidence is woefully lacking. I'm just not convinced at all by it. But the principle is that six falls short of perfect. It'll never be perfect. The number seven represents perfection many times in the book of Revelation. But six doesn't do it. 666 makes that emphatic. It'll never be perfect. And anybody who places his confidence in any man, not some specific man, but in any man, he will come up short every time. And I think that's the point that's being established in Revelation chapter 13, verse 18, considering the context of God's judgment upon the beast and upon him that worships the beast, which we see later in the 14th chapter. Again, those in the 14th chapter in verse 9, if any man worshipeth the beast and his image and receiveth a mark on his forehead or upon his hand, he shall drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is prepared unmixed in the cup of his anger. Now, if that's not judgment, I don't know what is. But John doesn't understand all of the applications of that. Now, when the angel in Revelation chapter 17 affirms, why do you wonder? I'm going to explain it to you. I'm going to tell you about this mystery. And so he proceeds to do that. The mystery of the woman and of the beast that carrieth her, which hath the seven heads and the ten horns. Now, which hath the seven heads and the ten horns, how does that identify this beast? Well, as we saw earlier in the 13th chapter, in the parallel of that, that would be Rome. Now, let's read on in the 8th verse. Any question about the 7th verse? Comment. Well, let's look again at the 17th chapter, going on to verse 8. It says, the beast that thou sawest was and is not, and is about to come up out of the abyss and go into perdition, and they that dwell on the earth shall wonder, they whose name hath not been written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they behold the beast, how that he was and is not and shall come. Now, are you confused yet? Well, some have described this passage as one of the most difficult in the book of Revelation. And it is difficult, admittedly so. But John is being told really an explanation of what he has seen in these previous verses. The beast that thou sawest was and is not, and is about to come up out of the abyss and go into perdition. And they that dwell on the earth dwellers that we were talking about in chapter 6, beginning in verse 9, they shall wonder, they whose name hath not been written in the book of life, how that he was and is not and shall come. They don't understand that. But the angel's telling John, I'm going to explain that to you. I'm going to explain that to you. Now, how does all this come to pass? Brethren, and those of you that are joining us, dear friends, admittedly, this passage is difficult. And I'm not sure I've got all the answers for it, but I want to bounce some things off of you and see how this might be identified and explain what these signs mean. And I think it's interesting to get an idea between what he saw and what John expected, because I think that what John expected is not the reality that the angel is explaining to him. There is the judgment of a city that perhaps John expects. Instead, he sees this beast and the harlot. The beast, and I want to try to make this as clear as I can, I'm convinced that the beast and the harlot the beast and the harlot are inseparable. I've studied some material in times gone by that wanted to make a very clear distinction between the beast and the harlot. And though there might be some degree of difference, I'm persuaded that it must be taken as a whole, that the beast represents Rome and the harlot doesn't represent something distinct from Rome, perhaps an entity within Rome. And that entity, I'm going to identify as the lust, the desire for political power, prestige, domination that Rome exerted upon the known world. Now, having said that, keep in mind, the angel is going to explain the meaning to John. This beast, and here's where we get into some difficulty, was and is not, and yet will be. In fact, the New King James translation uses the expression will ascend. Now, you see some similarities, no doubt, going back as we have tonight to Revelation, the 13th chapter, where there we read about a ruler who was and then seems to be raised. And we talked about that in the form of Nero, who ceased to be, and then others followed after him and made the empire worse than he had as far as persecuting Christians is concerned. But kingdoms come, kingdoms go, another one arises. Leaders do the same thing. They come and they go. And sometimes one who is yet to come is worse than what we've got now. And I'm sure that that was true and historically has been true. But John is being told that concerning this image, this came out of the abyss or out of the bottomless pit. Now, that expression is used in chapter 9, chapter 11, and we're going to come across it again in chapter 20. But one of the things that we'll see every time we see that expression is we're talking about the habitation of Satan or his agents. Now, I didn't say his angels. I said his agents. Can somebody become an agent of Satan? Well, yes. We saw that, and if you'll hold that thought, turn back with me to the 12th chapter. where we see the great dragon in verse 9 identified as the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. Now, as you bring that thought over into the 13th chapter in verse 2, it tells us that the dragon gave him, that is the beast that came up out of the sea, his power, his throne, and great authority. Now, did Satan have agents? Yes. Was Rome one of them? Yes. Yes. Now, that's what we see that John is being told. Now, getting back to the 17th chapter, in verse 9, the writer continues, "Here is the mind that hath wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sitteth, and they are seven kings. The five are fallen, and one is, and the other is not yet come. When he cometh, he must continue a little while. The beast that was and is not is himself also an eighth, and is of the seven, and he goeth into perdition." Are you confused yet? Admittedly, once again, these are complicated verses, but I want to note with you that the angel is explaining some things to John, and he's doing it with terms that are intended to be somewhat ambiguous. You'll note in this verse, verse 9, he says, "Here is the mind that hath wisdom." Does that sound familiar to you? Go back to the 13th chapter, and you'll notice again in verse 18, as he's explaining the number 666, he says, "Here is wisdom. He that hath understanding, let him count the number of the beast, for his number, it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. And brethren, there are some who say that here is the mind that hath wisdom. That term in and of itself means that this was during the time when the spiritual gifts were existent among Christians, and one of those spiritual gifts was the spiritual gift of wisdom. Now, though it is true that this was during the time of spiritual gifts, and though it is true that one of the spiritual gifts that you can read about in 1 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 8, one of those spiritual gifts is indeed the gift of wisdom. But to make the application to the book of Revelation, I think, is a far, far stretch. Some have said, well, this means then that certain ones had the spiritual gift of wisdom, and it was only those who exercised this spiritual gift of the Holy Spirit that could explain the vision that John saw. I'm not convinced that that's accurate. That's just a stretch of the imagery that John is using. Others say that here is wisdom, he that hath understanding, but that's just simply that you're smart enough to figure this out. I don't believe that either. What qualifications do you have that make you smart enough just to figure this out? No, these are things that the angel is explaining to John. The angel is making these things known to John, and he's doing it in terms that are symbolic. So here is the mind that hath wisdom, chapter 17, verse 9. And then he explains, the seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sitteth. Now, some say that the seven heads and the seven mountains, that's a literal description of the city of Rome. Though Rome was built on seven hills, I'm not persuaded that a literal interpretation of this is accurate. And my reason for that is the context itself. The seven heads are described as seven mountains on which the woman sitteth, and he tells us they are seven kings. So the seven heads are seven mountains, and they are seven kings. So he's not declaring literally seven mountains as a geographic location of the city that he is describing. The seven kings, some say, well, we can identify the various kings in the Roman Empire, and we can count them and assign to them when each one reigned, and therefore come to a conclusion with preciseness as to when the things that John is being told would come to pass. Friend, the book of Revelation is not about date setting. It's not about identifying the names of specific kings and specific things that they did. We know that the term seven is frequently used many, many times in the book of Revelation to indicate wholeness or completeness, perfection, if you please. Keep in mind that the letter is written to the seven churches of Asia Minor. What does that mean, that there were only seven churches in Asia Minor that needed to read this? Well, no. We know that there were other churches in Asia Minor, but the term seven is once again used to describe the whole. So, I'm sorry? 1 minute. Okay, thank you. So the seven kings would indicate the whole of the emperors of Rome. The seven kings would represent empires or kingdoms. Now in verse 10, he said the seven kings are of the seven kings, five are fallen, one is, the other is not yet come. And when he cometh, he must continue a little while. Now, I'm going to very quickly get this in front of you and consider it for next time. In verse 11, he continues, and the beast that was and is not is himself also an eighth and is of the seven, and he goeth unto perdition. How can there be an eighth, but he's of the seven? You see how complicated this begins to get. So what's John being told? Is the angel referring to literal kingdoms of men that reigned as world empires or such? Well, we've looked at the symbolic use of the numbers in the book of Revelation. Seven and five and one have very significant and somewhat consistent use in the book of Revelation. But what do they mean? Some have attempted to identify the names of all of these kings. And Richard, I see the need for me just to stop right there, because there's no way on earth for me to make this clear and hurry through it. I don't believe I can do that. So I'm going to stop sharing my slides just there and invite you to study that. Read some material on these kings that are identified in this text of Revelation 17. And what I want you to be impressed very much with is verse 14. I'm confident that verse 14 of this text sets forth the theme for the whole book. Now, maybe I've missed it, but I think it does. I think it sets forth the theme of the book when he said, "These shall war against the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them, for he is the Lord of lords and King of kings, and they also shall overcome that are with him, called and chosen and faithful." Now, if that's not what the book is about, I don't know. I think that represents a good thematic of the whole book of Revelation. And we'll talk next time about these kings in these preceding verses, verses 9 through verse 13, essentially. But there's no way that we can discuss that and do it justice in just a minute of time. So let me ask if there are any questions or comments that some would like to make as we wind up our study.
Mickey?
Yes?
I have a question, Stephanie.
Yes?
Okay. Yeah. So the kings that he's talking about are the kings that preceded, are the ones that came before the Lamb conquered them. So if we're talking about a literal king here, like the Roman Empire and stuff like that, then so would we be talking about the kings that preceded Constantine when they stopped killing Christians and actually made it the state religion? So are we going to be looking at those kings that preceded him? Because there's a boatload of them.
Way more than seven. There are. No, we're not going to look at all of the kings that preceded.
Well, but I mean, is that the era of the kings from the time of, what was it, Domitian or Titus or whenever those started till the time of Constantine?
Well, I think so. However, there are those who think that this is identifying the kings with the beginning, the very conception of the Roman Empire.
Yeah, but Christ wasn't born until.
I know, and that throws a fly in the ointment. And so we'll have to talk about that some. There's great okay. deal of discussion over exactly at what point the Roman Empire became an entity. When did it become an empire? Who was the first king of the empire? There, those who take the early date, late date, that's all beside the point. But when it became an empire, some begin with Julius Caesar. But we might note that there's a lot of discrepancy over whether or not Julius Caesar was to be counted because the empire was a republic at that time, you see. And then there are some kings that two or three reigned in a certain year of time. How do we count these when we're lining? So when we begin to try to identify specific kings and label them and number them, we run into a lot of difficulty. We're going to talk about why in our next study and why there might be a better approach. Did I see Bruce and then Denise? Okay, Denise.
So the seven mountains are not referring to the seven hills of Brown. Is that right?
I do not think so.
Based on?
The text itself.
Okay.
Because the text itself says in verse, I lost it. Seven heads and I'll find it next time. I'm looking probably right at it. Don't see it. Ten. Thank you. And there are seven kings. There you are. Verses 9 and 10. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sitteth, and they are seven kings. So I don't believe he's talking about literal hills.
Okay. That makes sense. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Though it be true that Rome sat on seven hills, the text itself tells us what the seven mountains were. Okay? Any other questions or comments? Thank you, Glendal, for pointing that out to me. I was looking kind of above it, not right at it. Well, if there's nothing further, then I'm going to extend the Lord's invitation to those who might be joining us who have a spiritual need. Perhaps it's to be baptized into Christ. We'll help you to do that. Or perhaps it's to confess error and call upon these brethren to pray with you and for you that you might be forgiven. We are assured that God extends forgiveness through the blood of his son. We can read that in 1 John chapter 1, beginning at verse 7. If we can do that, then that would be our delight.